Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Got my mojo working, but just don't work on you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us. Back in the studio live in New York City. Haven't been here in 5.5 months. Been on the road. Having really in-depth program today. We're going to be talking in the second part from Iowa with Steve Droecker about how the rise of GMOs was based upon subverting science and on deceiving the public. He is a public interest attorney and founder of the Alliance for Biointegrity. So we're going to learn the facts about how unsafe GMOs are and the control that the GMO industry has over the enormous apparatus of government. We're also going today to take a look at Food and Water Watch calls the FDA to declare GMO salmon unsafe to eat. Well, how would you know that you had GMO salmon? You wouldn't if it's not labeled. Also, is the federal government harassing and censoring its own scientists for studying the ties between pesticides and the massive bee death kill-off? And by the way, those bees are responsible for pollination, which leads to one-third of all the food grown in the United States. Also from Robert Reich, why Nike is the problem and not the solution. As many of us who are sharing information on the Trans-Pacific Partnership have been explaining, why in the world would the President of the United States, who said that he believes in transparency, keep this completely secret from legislators, from the media, yet completely open to all the transnational corporations, the Trans-Pacific Partnership? I have said that based upon what we've seen from WikiLeaks, that if this passes, then we will no longer have a sovereign nation. We will have a completely corporatized corporatocracy run by relatively few individuals and their corporations, and we will have no place we can go to get our rights back. Congress is selling us out. Also today, we're going to talk about America and what it's become. In fact, we're going to give you a couple commentaries, and one of those commentaries is corruption is now legal in the United States. That is correct. You will not go to jail. You will not be criticized. You won't even be in any way made to feel that you've done something reprehensible or immoral, unethical, or illegal. If you're in power today, you can write your own ticket. No one is going to hold you accountable. Also, today we're going to look at the history of the Aborigine and how they were treated in Australia by the British. The same kind of mindset that the British, under their current powers, the Tories, and the Conservatives are controlling Britain today and the extreme austerity programs they put Britons under. It's no different today. The same people that went into Australia and considered the inhabitants to be savages are the same people that had no problem using drones or aircraft in Iraq and Afghanistan and in Libya or in Syria. Also today, we will look at how a lot of people are not getting enough vitamin D, but if you do get enough vitamin D, it can help you lose some weight. And also the health benefits of sunlight, the latest science on that. And all of this comes from mainstream peer-reviewed literature. And eating dark chocolate, well, that can beat the midday slump and a lot more. Let's begin. We know that we should be getting our vitamin D. It can help prevent depression and heart disease and faulty immunity, which can lead to cancer. The University of Milan has a new study that shows if you're overweight, you're almost always low on vitamin D, and therefore taking a supplement of vitamin D can help you, and that is important. And they're suggesting higher doses than what the average American would take. In fact, quote, the new study included 400 overweight and obese people with vitamin D deficiency were put on a low-calorie diet and then divided in three groups. One group took no vitamin D, another group took 25,000 units, another group took 100,000 units per month. After 6 months, participants in both vitamin D groups had lost more weight and had greater reductions in their waistline than those who hadn't taken the supplement. And this was a part of the European Congress on Obesity expert study. So, good study. Now think of how many Americans are overweight or obese and they don't get their vitamin D. Especially if you're depressed, make sure you're getting 5,000 units of vitamin D3 each day. Now, one way you get your vitamin D is going in the sun. But the trouble is we're so phobic about sunburn that we lather ourselves with so much sun-blocking agent that the vitamin D doesn't get produced even when we're out in the sun. So you got my suggestion is you go in the sun, and before you go in, you take a lot of vitamin C and quercetin and E, and that helps protect you from the sun. But it doesn't shield you from the sun. Then when you come back out of the sun, you take those same supplements all over again, and that can help neutralize the effects so you don't get the sunburn, but you got the vitamin D. This is the latest. Sunlight supports vitamin D for a healthy mood. Quote, vitamin D is known as the sunshine vitamin because, as most of us know, it is produced in the skin upon exposure to sunlight. Now research shows it creates a positive mood. A study published in the Journal of Nutrition found a 34% lower risk of depression in workers whose blood vitamin D levels were higher. So, the takeaway message, get more vitamin D up to your body requirements and helps prevent depression. Also, I remember I got a call once from a friend of mine, Robert Atkins. And Bob and I used to socialize and hang out together. Yes, we had completely different. I was a vegan and he was a big meat eater. Bob would eat a cow live if he could, if it'd stay still long enough for him to devour about half of it. And he had the biggest selling health book in history and made a lot of money. Made a lot of friends, made some enemies. But then it kind of all turned against him. And he said, I was going out on tour, and he said, could he go out with me? I said, sure. So we had several weeks we spent together on the road going to major cities. And what we focused upon was not the high-protein or low-protein diets or the vegan diet. Instead, what we focused upon is how corrupt our federal government agencies are and how they're antagonistic towards anything involving alternative healing. And but once at dinner, we went into this Indian restaurant. I ordered all of their vegetable dishes. But sometimes the Indians will overcook. And I said, I want this very lightly cooked, so there's still crunch in the cauliflower. And they were thoughtful enough, and they did that. And you get little tiny dishes. When I say a little tiny cup, it's a tiny cup, enough for about 3 forkfuls. But you get a whole platter of them. And then you can try, you know, you can mix it with your rice that's on the platter, the basmati rice. So I'm having this dish, and Bob's having this huge steak and with lots of fat. And I said, Bob, I said, do you realize how many of your patients I counsel who come in, they've lost some weight, but now they've got problems with high blood pressure, their kidneys, they're suffering from constipation, because there's no fiber in meat, and it will really clog you up. And if you want to see how you can get in a bad mood very quickly, go without a bowel movement for a week. You know, and then you see those frowns, you see people who say, well, anything for a bowel movement. So I said, Bob, you're probably the biggest causer of constipation right now in the United States. And so he didn't change. You know, his idea was, well, we're losing weight and that's it. This is the latest from the Ruiz Health Research Institute in Spain. A major study, quote, high-protein diet may be dangerous for those at risk of heart disease. I'll quote this. A high-protein diet may backfire for people at risk of heart disease, increasing the likelihood of weight gain and early death. Replacing carbohydrates and fats with protein is touted as a quick way to weight loss, but this long-term Spanish study of older adults found these high-protein diets, think Atkins and South Beach, for example, may be harmful. When protein replaced carbohydrates, for instance, the eating plan was linked to a 90% greater risk of gaining more than 10% of your body weight. Let me give you an example. If you're a 200-pound guy, you just gain 20 pounds on a high-protein diet. And also, it was also linked to a 59% higher risk of death from any cause. Let me repeat that. For all the people in this audience who believe in the high-protein diet, and I believe in a low-protein diet from let's say, plants, quote, you can gain a 90% greater risk of gaining 10% of your body weight, but it's also linked with a 59% higher risk of death from any cause. When protein replaced fat, risk of death rose 66%. Quote, these results, and then it goes on to talk about the outcome. And they looked at 7,000 men and women for quite some time. It also increased the risk of type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure and elevated cholesterol. So Americans love the high-protein diet because it means they don't have to really change anything. Still eating bad food. So that's the latest. Now, finally, on eating dark chocolate. There's a lot of ways to eat chocolate. One is to get the highest quality organic dark chocolate with no sugar and no dairy. That's the best way of using it. And otherwise, you can get it with cream in it, not good, milk, not good, sugar, not good. So it negates the beneficial effects. Now, this is from Northern Arizona University. Talked about the high cacao content of chocolate, which is being researched. Quote, chocolate is indeed a stimulant and it activates the brain in a really special way. This is according to the professor of sciences at Northern Arizona University. Quote, it can increase brain characteristics of attention, and it also significantly affects blood pressure levels. It means it lowers them. So, if you have high blood pressure, and if you don't have good cognition, if you have memory loss, Alzheimer's, brain fog, brain fatigue, then according to this article published in the journal Neuroregulation, you could end up having a better outcome with 2 ounces of dark chocolate a day. Oh, and by the way, this is the latest, and I'm going to try to get this in if my publisher is listening. Today, the University of Athens, quote, Mediterranean diet and other lifestyle factors in relation to a 20-year all-cause death. Quote, the aim of the present analysis was to evaluate the association of the Mediterranean diet, smoking habits, and physical activity to all-cause death in an Italian population during a 20-year follow-up study. A total of 1,693 subjects, 4074, were enrolled, and adherence to the Mediterranean diet was evaluated by the Mediterranean Dietary Score. And what they found is that a substantial length in lifespan, a reduction in death overall from all causes, and a 73% reduced risk of death respectively. Wow. So quite simply, the vegetarian diet, principally vegetarian, they have fish, but the vegetarian Mediterranean diet, you could live longer, have less chance for sudden death, heart attack, stroke, diabetes. Now compare that to what I just gave you about the high-protein Atkins, South Beach, and other high-protein diets. Oh, one last thing. If you have high blood pressure, Griffin University in Australia said flaxseed consumption can lower it. Quote, high blood pressure is a major health burden positively associated with the risk of cardiovascular disease and chronic disease. Flaxseed is a rich dietary source of alpha, linolenic acid, lignans, and fiber with a number of positive health and blood pressure lowering benefits. This was published on PubMed online, and it was a part of the Nursing and Allied Health Literature and Cochrane Research Group. So take your flaxseed and lower your blood pressure. Tomorrow, more on health and nutrition. We're going to take a brief break. And by the way, I realize sometimes people are not always able to be at your land-based station or listening over the Internet. But you can sure listen by telephone. Let me give you this number to always carry it with you. So if you're out someplace and it's noon Eastern Standard Time and you want to hear the show and you have no other way of hearing it, just call this number. As I believe about 16 million minutes of listening has occurred, we're number one in America, North America, out of 4,500 stations. 712-432-7231. 712-432-7231. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
I know you don't know what I'm going through, standing here looking at you. But let me tell you that it hurts so bad. It makes me feel so sad.
Nice to be with you, and nice to be back in New York City after 5.5 months on the road. The good news is that we did a health retreat as a fundraiser for our sister station, WBAI, and the results were really positive. Some major health benefits. And that was good. It took a lot of energy and a lot of time, but it was worth it for those people. Plus, I have completed the newest film, and I'll be premiering it in about 3.5 to 4 weeks from now. I'll announce it shortly as soon as my post-production people and working in New York, I've been sending back the film footage. They've been editing it. It's a powerful film. I won't say anything more about it. You don't know anything about it. Haven't mentioned it at all. I have mentioned another film I've been filming on the Manufacturing Madness, but this is one that I don't know anyone who's going to be able to watch this and not be moved to do something. Also, there's always kind of a little ritual when I come back to the city. About 2 hours after being back, I'd get a call from my longtime friend Marty Feldman saying, okay, movie time. And he'd run down the list of all the movies, and then we would see which ones to go to, picking one per week, and a bunch of us would get together and go see a movie, have dinner. It was a lot of fun. He's passed, so that's gone. Another friend, Wendell Tronick's passed. A longtime professional friend. We didn't hang out together, but we spent a lot of time talking, going over projects, and that was Danny Schechter, and he's gone. And then we have Utrice Lead. And unfortunately, not good news with Utrice. And it was interesting because I told Jason when he told me, oh, she went in the hospital for food poisoning. I said, No, it's not going to be that. It's going to be a life-challenging illness. Well, it's stage 4 cancer, metastasized uterine cancer to the breast, to the lungs. And after opening her up, they couldn't do anything, and they said that she should seek what is called quality of life, meaning put your life in order and seek out hospice care if you need it, or pass at home. Anyhow, needless to say, once I found out, I let her know. And so I went out of my way, and I met with her on Friday and gave her a holistic protocol. So the best that I could give her, she has. So, and I'm calling her every day, making sure she's sticking with the protocol. And she says she is. And when I met her, she was walking on a cane and could barely walk. And today she said this morning she walked a mile. Okay, well, that's good. You know, it's the beginning, because every day she's alive now is a day that she's not supposed to be alive. And it's interesting what happens when people wake up one day and they're told, you know, it's the end. You have days or weeks to live. Two things they generally will say to you that they wouldn't have otherwise. What they regretted in life not doing, and what they regret in life in doing, the two mistakes we make, and all you can do at that moment is be compassionate, understanding, but also, in my world, I don't accept that that we should simply give up. I believe that there's always something we can do because there's so many people who are alive today as evidence of that. So let us hope that with all that she is capable of doing at this moment in her life, that she will live another day. Now, I want to give you a little piece of Robert Reich's mind. It's short, but I think it says a lot. And this is about why I oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Quote, tomorrow, well, this actually has already occurred. So President Obama will be giving a speech promoting the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Paradoxically, he is chosen to give it at Nike headquarters in Oregon. Nike isn't a solution to the problem of stagnant wages in America. Nike is the problem. It's true that over the past 2 years, Nike has added 2,000 good-paying professional jobs at its Oregon headquarters, fulfilling the requirements of a controversial tax break it wrangled from the state legislature. That's good for Nike's new design and research and marketing employees. But Nike's U.S. workers make up only a tiny percentage of Nike products. In fact, Americans made up only 1% of the products that generated Nike's $27 billion revenue last year. And Nike is moving ever more of its production abroad. Last year, a third of Nike's remaining 13,922 American production workers were laid off. Most of Nike's products are made by 990,000, nearly a million workers in low-wage countries whose abysmal working conditions have made Nike a symbol of global sweatshop labor. As wages have risen in China, Nike has switched most of its production to Vietnam, where wages are less than 60 cents an hour. Almost 340,000 workers cut and assemble Nike products there. In other words, Nike is a global corporation with no particular loyalty or connection to the United States. Its loyalty is in its global shareholders. I'm not faulting Nike. Nike is only playing by the rules. I'm faulting the rules. Trade agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership protect corporate investors, but lead to even more offshoring of American jobs. They make it safer for firms to relocate abroad. The Cato Institute describes such investor protection as, quote, lowering the risk premium on offshoring, thereby reducing corporate incentives to keep jobs in America and upgrade the skills of Americans. If the Trans-Pacific Partnership goes into effect, American wages will be dragged down by further losses of manufacturing jobs. All workers with similar skill levels face downward wage pressure when Americans displaced from better-paying manufacturing jobs join the glut of workers competing for non-offshore jobs. Jobs being lost to imports pay America's higher wages than the jobs left behind. Government data show wages in the import company industries, manufacturing jobs, beat those of exporting industries overall. We can't educate our way out of this. American workers with a four-year college degree are also highly vulnerable to job offshoring. And a researcher found that one out of every four American jobs in finance, information technology, and professional services could be offshored in the foreseeable future. Here's the bottom line. We need new rules for the global economy that allow Americans to win. Instead, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which includes 12 nations, including Vietnam, but would be open for every nation to join, would lock us into an expanded version of the very policies that have failed most Americans over the past 20 years. The White House says the Trans-Pacific Partnership includes strong labor and environmental standards, but these are the same standards included in George W. Bush's last agreements. No doubt Nike is supporting the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The corporations would get a tax cut on its Vietnamese and Malaysian-made goods. But even with the tariffs in place, Nike's current expenses for those 100-plus shoes are less than $10 a pair. So don't expect the tax cut to result in cheaper price for American consumers. Needless to say, the Trans-Pacific Partnership would require Nike to pay its Vietnamese workers more. Nike workers are not paid enough to buy the shoes they make, much less buy U.S. exported goods. Nike may be the perfect example of life under the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but that is not a future many Americans would choose. That's from Robert Reich. I'm Gary Nall. Now, let's hear a little piece on corruption is now legal in America.
For the last few years, I've had this sense that everything I learned as a kid about how America's government works is completely wrong. But I had no idea how bad things actually were until I saw this one graph. Researchers at Princeton University looked at more than 20 years' worth of data to answer a pretty simple question. Does the government represent the people? Now, this is what they found. This axis here represents public support for any given idea. On the left, at 0%, are ideas that not a single American wants. On the right, at 100%, are ideas that everyone supports. This axis represents the likelihood of Congress passing a law that reflects any of these ideas, from a 0 to a 100% chance. On this graph, an ideal republic would look like this. If 50% of the public supports an idea, there's a 50% chance of it becoming law. If 80% of us support something, there's an 80% chance. You get the idea. Now, most Americans would probably agree that, with a few exceptions, we should be as close to this ideal as possible. Unfortunately, the way America actually works doesn't even come close. Take an idea that nobody supports, literally nobody, and it has about a 30% chance of becoming federal law. Now, take an incredibly popular idea, the most popular idea this country has ever seen, and there's also about a 30% chance of it becoming law. This means that the number of American voters for or against any idea has no impact on the likelihood that Congress will make it law. Put another way, and I'm just going to quote the Princeton study directly here, the preferences of the average American appear to have only a minuscule, near zero, statistically non-significant impact upon public policy. So if you've ever felt like your opinion doesn't matter and that the government doesn't really care what you think, well, you're right. But there's a catch. This flat line only accounts for the bottom 90% of income earners in America. Economic elites, business interests, people who can afford lobbyists, they get their own line. Look at how much closer their line is to the ideal. When they want something, the government is much more likely to do it. And when they don't, they have the power to completely block it from happening, no matter how much the rest of the country supports it. They get what they want, and guess who ends up paying for it? We pay for it with the most expensive healthcare in the world. We pay for it with a tax code that's a complete mess. We pay for it with internet that's slower and more expensive, with wasteful spending, a floundering education system, a catastrophic drug war, and one in five American children born into poverty. Almost every major issue we face as a nation can be traced back to this graph. How does this happen? Well, just follow the money. Right now, it's perfectly legal to buy political influence in America. Here's how it works. Let's say a big bank wants a law that would force taxpayers to bail them out again if they repeat the exact same reckless behavior that crashed the global economy in 2008. Not exactly the most popular idea with the public, and Congress knows that. That should be the end of it. But that's where the money comes in.
It's perfectly legal for our bank to hire a team of lobbyists whose entire job is to make sure that the government gives the bank what it wants. Then those lobbyists can track down members of Congress who regulate banks and help raise a ton of money for their re-election campaigns. It's perfectly legal for those lobbyists to offer those same politicians million-dollar jobs at their lobbying firm. Then those lobbyists can literally write the language of this new bailout law themselves and hand it off to the politician they just buttered up with campaign money and lucrative job offers. And it's perfectly legal for those politicians to take the lobbyist-written language and sneak it through Congress at the last second. So now you've got a law that greatly benefits the banks, and the whole process can start over. This is how a bill becomes a law. A special interest hires some lobbyists, those lobbyists collect campaign contributions, offer jobs, and then write the laws that Congress then passes to help those same special interests. This happens every day on every single issue with politicians of both parties. In the last 5 years alone, the 200 most politically active companies in the United States spent $5.8 billion influencing your government. Those same companies got $4.4 trillion in taxpayer support. And that's trillion, with a T. And that's just the top 200 companies. Never mind every other special interest, every union, every trade association, and every billionaire. Every single one of them can use their money to buy political influence. You know, there's this idea out there that this only became a problem after the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision in 2010. But the data goes back almost 40 years, and the results are clear. Corruption is legal in America. And as long as it is, anyone who can spend money to buy political influence will. The solution here isn't rocket science. Make corruption illegal. We already know Congress won't do it. I mean, one look at this chart will tell you that. What we need is a plan that lets us go around Congress and do what the American people do best.
And that's what we should do. We should simply demand of our legislators legislation that makes all donations, all contributions of any kind from any source illegal, that all elections at every level should be completely free of outside money. Take the money out of politics, and suddenly you take a lot of the corruption out of politics. Now, from Food and Water Watch, Food and Water Watch filed two legal petitions yesterday asking the FDA to evaluate Aqua Bounty, its genetically engineered salmon, as a food additive instead as an animal drug, and to declare GMO salmon unsafe to eat based upon the food additive review process. Quote, it couldn't be more clear to consumers that GMO salmon is a food, not a drug. It's also clear that there are serious food safety concerns with this fish and major scientific gaps in FDA's animal drug risk assessment. It's time for the FDA to step up and protect the health and welfare of American citizens rather than the economy and the biotech industry. And that was from Food and Water Watch. We would agree the last thing you want is a genetically engineered salmon because you do not know what would happen in your body when the genomes of that salmon intermix with yours. Now, before we go to our guest, let's take a look at what is happening around the world as far as not understanding why today regimes that support free trade are also supporting imperialism, whether it's in Africa trying to control the land and control the seeds, Monsanto and Bono and others who want to see that the natives are not fed, they're not helped. No, their land is exploited, seeds. And so whatever they have to do to get the people off the land, they'll do. But there's a long history of this. In the colonies, they did it. But one of the best at doing it, one of the best countries for imperialism and colonial rule was Britain. And of course, Britain controlled Australia. Let's just show you a little bit of its dark history.
Than animals, which was to justify not only the theft of their land, but their extermination. An edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, still in circulation when I was at school, described them as only an animal of prey, more ferocious than the leopard or the hyena. He devours his own species. So they were hunted and raped and massacred. And few doubted at the time that genocide was official policy. A government report in the 1850s spoke of the success of poisoning Aborigines, 100 of them laid out at a time. But until quite recently, little of this was even acknowledged. In Tasmania, the Aborigines were said to have died out. In fact, they were hunted along with kangaroos and almost wiped out. In New South Wales, by 1845, the tribe who had watched Captain Cook sail here into Botany Bay was reduced to 3 women and a man. In Victoria, an Aborigine called Old Mr. Burt recalled this story told by his mother.
They buried our babies with only their heads above the ground. All in a row they were. Then they had a test to see who could kick the babies' heads off the furthest. One man clobbered a baby's head off from horseback. They then spent most of the day raping the women. Most of them were then tortured to death by sticking sharp things like spears up their vaginas until they died. They tied the men's hands behind their backs, then cut off their penis and testicles and watched them run around screaming until they died.
One of the most enduring myths about the Aborigines is that they did not fight back. In fact, a war of resistance lasted more than a century, some of it here on the banks of the Hawkesbury River, north of Sydney. During the 1930s, my father built a cottage here, on the beach at an Aboriginal place called Patonga. I think we knew that somebody had lived at Patonga at some time, but no one talked about it. In fact, an entire nation had lived here on and off for thousands of years. They were called the Jurag, a unique Aboriginal people, tall and slender, whose country extended to a 40-mile radius north of Sydney, and the mighty Hawkesbury River was theirs. And when the British established the town of Windsor in the early 1800s, a great war began. This war was not recorded in the Imperial Chronicles of Australia. Growing up here, I knew nothing about it, and I suspect that's still true of the people in the smart beach houses here today. And yet the Jurag inflicted on the British a casualty rate greater than that sustained by the Australian Armed Forces during all of World War II. And finally, after 22 years, outnumbered and without guns, they went down fighting to the last man, woman and child, a complete nation. Today, in a land of many cenotaphs and war memorials on which invariably is written, lest we forget, not one of them stands for those who fought and fell in their own country. By the 1920s, the British invasion had caused the deaths of at least 250,000 black Australians. Genocide on a massive scale. But this fact remained suppressed, except in the living memory of those who survived.
Here in the Northern Territory, in the great isolated heartland of Australia, the killing of Aborigines continued well into the 20th century, and most of these also remained secret. However, in 1928, 150 miles from Alice Springs, a gang of police and cattlemen massacred at least 50 Aborigines, perhaps many more, and word got out. A public inquiry was held, and its findings were summarized in these three words: the shooting was justified. In giving evidence, Constable William Murray said, "We shot to kill. What use is a wounded blackfella 100 miles from civilized Australia?" The nation on the other side of the frontier has risen from its deathbed and has begun to fight back. And what a spectacle it is. As the first Australians challenge some of the greatest transnational companies in the world, and governments, and historians, and assumptions and attitudes, and disease and neglect, in order that they may claim back their share of the oldest continent, their country. This film is a glimpse of their epic story. When Captain Cook landed here in Botany Bay, he was under orders not to raise the Union Jack without the consent of the inhabitants of Australia. But Cook and Captain Arthur Phillip, who followed with the first fleet of convicts, both disobeyed these instructions. And what followed was one of the darkest and least known periods in the history of Britain's empire.
The British declared Australia an empty land, in spite of the fact that there were tribes with a total population of at least 300,000, perhaps as many as 1 million. No one knew exactly, because the first Australians were not counted as human beings. Decimation was swift. Aboriginal blood carried no resistance to white disease. Lieutenant Brady, Royal Marines, reported in 1788, "From the great number of dead natives found in every part of Sydney Harbour, it appears that the smallpox has made dreadful havoc among them." But not nearly as much havoc as massacre. No British colony was born under so cruel a star as Australia. The early convict ships had brought thousands of white slaves, mostly English and Irish, transported for crimes of poverty and politics. And they became the instruments of massacre, directed by Christian gentlemen who had brought with them attitudes of racial superiority that were the staple of empire. Ironically, their cruelty was at odds with liberal reformers in Britain who were then seeking to end the slave trade. In 1837, a House of Commons select committee condemned the atrocities against the Aborigines. But the difference between sympathy and action was a convenient 15,000 miles.
I'm calling a corroboree of all the natives of New South Wales to send a petition to the King in an endeavour to improve our condition. All the black man wants is representation in federal parliament. There is also plenty of fish in the river for us all, and land to grow all we want. 150 years ago, the Aboriginals owned Australia, and today he demands more than the white man's charity. He wants the right to live.
At that time, the 1930s, the Protection Acts were in full force. The chief protector had the power to send mixed-blood children to missions, having wrenched them away from their Aboriginal mothers. In this way, the mothers could continue to serve their white masters, the masters were saved any possible embarrassment, and the children were civilized with Christian ritual. If any Aborigine objected to this arrangement, the chief protector could imprison him or her without trial, all of which, said the law, was to save the natives from being overwhelmed by the white race. In recent years, many of those children sent to the missions have tried to find their families.
Well, the first time with me, as the story goes, is my grandpa said, you don't take that kid, you know, so I was left. He stopped him, but then the following year, months later, he came back again, and then I was out with some other kids, and most of the old people had gone away from the station. And so Constable Bill McKinnon was able to take me, put me on the camel, and take me, you know, till people realised the day after, or the 2 days after, that I was missing. Yeah.
Still taking the Aboriginal children today. I'm Gary Nall. Let's now go out to Iowa. We're standing by. I had mentioned him earlier. Is Stephen Droeker, public interest attorney and founder of the Alliance for Biointegrity. His website is biointegrity.org, and he is the author of Altered Genes, Twisted Truth, How the Venture to Genetically Engineer Our Food Has Subverted Science, Corrupted Government, and Systematically Deceived the Public. Nice to have you with us today, Stephen.
Good to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Stephen, since your 1998 lawsuit against the FDA over GMO safety, there has been a growing body of scientific literature published confirming the health and environmental risks of GMOs and big agriculture's pesticides, particularly Monsanto's glyphosate, or Roundup. Now, right now, the verdict is in from peer-reviewed science that GMO imperils a person's quality of life and other species far from what we might have imagined 20 years ago, and this body of scientific literature will only increase, not decline, in the future. However, as a result of your lawsuit, you obtained over 44,000 pages of documents indicating that the industry, before the Clinton administration, became the politicos behind Monsanto and GMOs, serious risks for introducing GMOs were already known. So they knew this. So please summarize for us what has already been known about the dangers of GMOs prior to FDA approval, and how did the FDA and other prestigious scientific organizations like the American Academy of Science, the Royal Society in the United Kingdom, and others manage to remain silent and proceed with a cover-up for so long? The forum is yours.
Well, it's a very astounding story, a very sorry story, but one that needed to be told, and my book does tell it. As you mentioned, the 44,000 pages plus that the FDA was forced to hand over during the lawsuit that I initiated against them definitely showed that their own biotechnology task force, which was comprised of experts from the various key agencies, various key departments within the Food and Drug Administration, had overwhelmingly concluded that genetic engineering is very different than traditional breeding, that it entails different risks, and that therefore every food that it produces has to be carefully tested for new toxins or new allergens or other problems before it comes to market. Now, of course, that's what U.S. food safety law requires anyway. So it's very important to emphasize that from both a legal standpoint and from a scientific standpoint, the FDA knew that every one of these foods was supposed to be carefully tested before it came to market. What happened was the politically appointed administrators, who acknowledged they'd been promoting a policy to following a policy to promote the U.S. biotechnology industry, that began under the Reagan presidency, they covered all of that up, and in public they lied. In May of 1992, their policy statement on genetically engineered foods stated that the FDA was not aware of any information showing that foods derived by these new methods differed in any meaningful or uniform way from other foods. That's an outright lie. Their files had quite a bit of information from their own scientists, and 24 key documents from the FDA's files are posted on the website of the Alliance for Biointegrity, biointegrity.org, so people don't have to take my word for it. And then the FDA allowed every one of these foods to come to market without having the requirement of a smidgen of safety testing. So they flagrantly broke the law. They subverted the best science as their own scientists had conveyed it to them, and they've been getting away with it. Now, it's not just the FDA that has been playing shenanigans here on behalf of genetically engineered foods. As you mentioned, my book demonstrates how the National Academy of Sciences, the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, American Association for the Advancement of Science, how the British Royal Society have also gotten into the act, have suppressed key evidence or distorted facts. And so it's not that those other organizations have remained silent. They've been quite vocal. But what they have said, their statements in regard to genetically engineered foods, have basically pervaded disinformation. And that's so unbefitting eminent scientific organizations. And my book shows that without the FDA fraud, without the fraud committed by eminent scientists and scientific institutions, no genetically engineered foods could have come to market. The whole venture would have collapsed if the facts had have been aired properly back in the early 90s. And this whole major venture rests on a foundation of falsehood and fraud. It's so precarious. And that's why the proponents viciously attack any research or any scientists who bring out research that raises questions about genetically engineered foods. And as you mentioned, Gary, there are several well-conducted, peer-reviewed studies published in scientific literature that demonstrate one or another problem of genetically engineered foods. And that research has been viciously attacked. It's been denied. It's been whatever suppression or distortion could be used has been used to make the public feel and the media that there are not any good studies that have shown questions. And in fact, the routine party line that is put out by the biotech industry and is parroted in the media today is that there's overwhelming consensus in the scientific community these foods are safe, and that the evidence has proven they're safe, and that therefore we should all just shut up and eat them. And it's just amazing, because the facts are so contrary. There's never been a consensus within the scientific community that these foods are safe, and that there's substantial evidence calls their safety into question.
Stephen,
and yet that's not the message that the public is hearing.
Stephen, what were some of the more outrageous, heinous activities of the FDA and regulatory health and food officials that you uncovered in the documents?
Well, as I said, the main one was actually just lying back in May of 1992 when the policy statement was brought out and claiming that the agency was not aware of any information showing that these foods differed in any uniform or meaningful way from other foods, when they had memo after memo from their own experts explaining why these genetic engineering is different and why the foods that it produces do entail a different set of risks and have to be presumed unsafe until demonstrated safe, which is what the law requires anyway. But there's been more over the years. The very first ingestible product of genetic engineering was a food supplement of the essential amino acid L-tryptophan. And that created a major epidemic in 1989 and 1990. It killed dozens of Americans. It seriously sickened thousands other Americans, hundreds of whom remain invalids to this day. Now, the FDA, even though the scientists studying, these scientists outside the FDA, studying that epidemic, concluded that L-tryptophan itself could not have been the cause of that epidemic, that there was some rare toxic contamination that had occurred, and many of them felt that genetic engineering was the most likely cause. Even the FDA in private had acknowledged, I found this in its files, the FDA's own biotechnology coordinator acknowledged that genetic engineering could not be ruled out as the cause of that unusual toxic contamination. In public, the FDA has basically claimed genetic engineering had nothing to do with it. And in fact, when the FDA testified, when a top official of the FDA testified before Congress, he didn't even let the congressman know that genetic engineering was involved in manufacturing that product. He blamed it all on health supplements and said that this just showed why it was important for the FDA to be able to regulate health supplements, because the FDA has been trying for years to regulate health food supplements and bring them under its control. And so the FDA, and in many other ways, the FDA has, as my book demonstrates, has brought out false statements about that food epidemic to try to take the blame off and all the attention off of genetic engineering and put it on health food supplements.
Stephen,
so that's another of the great crimes, I would say.
Okay.
We should call it.
But Stephen, we can certainly find plenty of serious faults and even crimes, as you just mentioned, of negligence and fraud with government agencies like the FDA and the USDA. There's another issue we don't speak about much. While Monsanto regularly ranks at or near the top of the list of the most despised corporations in the world, they employ many thousands of scientists to do their research and obviously to cover up their findings as well. And then the organizations such as the American Academy of Sciences that support junk science. So could you speak a little of how it is not just the corporate cartels that are the problem, but a much larger scientific cartel comprised of molecular biologists, geneticists, plant scientists, and much more, who deceive the public as well because they're getting paid. They're getting research grants.
It's a very good point you bring out, Gary. And in fact, my book makes the point that as bad as Monsanto and the rest of the industry have been, they are not the main culprits, because they could have never gotten away with what they've been doing. And in fact, the whole genetic engineering of our food could not have gotten going if the groundwork had not been laid back in the early 70s by eminent scientists and scientific institutions that were misrepresenting the basic facts of what genetic engineering is. Technically, it's called recombinant DNA technology. In fact, some major misrepresentations were already being dispensed, and regulation of our government was being staved off through these misrepresentations before there even was a biotechnology industry. That's a very important point to understand. Even before there was a biotechnology industry at all, there was misrepresentation going on by eminent scientists and scientific institutions. And once the biotech industry began, And then when genetic engineering expanded into agriculture, the level of disinformation had to intensify. And it was not just the Monsantos of the world doing it. Again, each year after year, this whole venture has relied upon continued misrepresentations being dispensed by eminent scientists and scientific institutions. And it could not have continued without it. So without the complicity of the National Academy of Sciences, without the complicity of Britain's Royal Society, this whole venture would have tanked.
And one more here. Let's add in Burst and Marsteller, the big PR firm, and also Bill Clinton is the one of the biotech presidents, not just regarding GMOs, but in medical biotechnology and Human Genome Project as well. And it was during Hillary's stint as Secretary of State when the GMO agenda became a part of American foreign policy. However, Bill was already pressuring nations to accept genetically modified crops as soon as they entered the market. Now Hillary is running for president. I have serious concern about America's future food security, as well as many other nations. Could you briefly, because we're almost out of time, talk about the Clinton's incestuous relationship with Monsanto, Big Agra, and its favoritism towards genetically modified crops?
Well, definitely when Bill Clinton was president, he was a major cheerleader and promoter of genetically engineered food and the biotech industry in general, and he's admitted that. He said, I was probably the biggest booster of biotechnology. And he said, if anybody can show me any reason why I shouldn't have been, you know, I'll change my tune on that. He said that just a few years ago. Well, if you read my book, he'd see. I'm hoping that he and Hillary will both read the book, because I believe they've been hoodwinked. You know, they listened to scientists in whom they had a right to trust, who kept telling them this is safe. And however, of course, they did when president, he allowed too many unsavory connections between his administration and Monsanto. That had been going on before he was president. It continued. And people would leave the Clinton administration and go right to important positions in Monsanto or become board members of Monsanto. It was a scandal. It was at scandalous proportions. So the Clintons have a lot of, and as you mentioned, Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, was definitely pursuing the U.S. policy of pushing these foods overseas. So they have a lot of amends to make, I think. And hopefully, when they learn the facts, they will realize that they were really on the wrong side of science, on the wrong side of the law, and they can make a major turnaround. That's my hope. I still give them the benefit of the doubt.
I don't.
I think they've been hoodwinked.
No, they're too smart, and they have a long, long history of playing the game for money. Stephen, thank you very much for being on. We appreciate your concern and the very good book called Altered Genes, Twisted Truth, How the Venture to Genetically Engineer Our Food Has Subverted Science, Corrupted Government, and Systematically Deceived the Public. The website is biointegrity.org. Stephen Droecker, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Gary.
And we're out of time, everyone. I want to thank you for listening in today, and I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone. Now let's go down and say hello to Utrice. Hi, Utrice. Do we have Utrice? No? She'll be here in a moment.